From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas de Torrente of Doctors Without Borders about providing medical relief in Afghanistan under the Taliban. He spent last month in Afghanistan visiting the group's clinics. After September 11th, the organization evacuated its foreign nationals from the country. Now that there's a new name for the war against terrorism, Operation Enduring Freedom, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the practice of naming military operations. And our new poet laureate, Billy Collins, returns to Fresh Air to read some poems from his new book and to talk about taking on his new responsibilities in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush again today condemned attacks against Arab Americans, Muslims, Sikhs, and others in the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11th. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The White House remains concerned about a backlash against people in the U.S. who are Muslims or who appear to be of Middle Eastern descent. Mr. Bush met with a group of Sikh community leaders at the White House. Sikhs, as part of their religion, do not cut their hair, and men wear turbans, but they are not Muslims. The president shared with them his outrage over the recent killing of a Sikh businessman in Arizona.
These citizens bring their hearts with them, and I can assure them that our government will do everything we can to not only bring those people to justice, but also to treat every human life as dear and to respect the values that made our country so different and so unique.
The president later covered the same topic in a meeting with a group of Muslim community leaders. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani said today he would talk with the city's mayoral candidates to come up with a plan that would give him some ongoing role in the recovery effort. Giuliani was not specific about whether he's seeking some kind of extension of his term, considering a late run for a third term, or merely a role in the administration of his successor. Giuliani says he won't announce his intentions until he explains his plan to the candidates.
We have a very, very strong spirit of unity right now, and I think that it's my obligation to try to maintain it. So I can't tell you what that is until I tell them, and I've met with some of them, but not all of them yet.
Giuliani's comments came at a news conference where the mayor announced new temporary restrictions on drivers coming into Lower Manhattan. Iran's supreme leader condemned the United States today and vowed that Tehran would not cooperate with any U.S.-led attack on Afghanistan. From Beirut, NPR's Kate Seeley reports.
In a speech to the nation, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei accused the U.S. of lacking the sincerity and competence to guide a global movement against terrorism. "We're not with you," he said, referring to the U.S. "At the same time, we don't support terrorists," he added. Iran has said it would be willing to join a United Nations-led campaign to fight terrorism, but has warned against unilateral U.S. military strikes against Afghanistan, claiming they would cause a catastrophe. Iran quickly condemned the September 11th attacks on its longtime foe, the U.S., raising hopes of warming relations between the two countries. But Khamenei's hardline speech, punctuated by shouts of death to America from the audience, made it clear that Iran wants no part in a U.S.-led anti-terror campaign. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 92 points to 85.67. The Nasdaq was down 37, and the S&P 500 closed down 5 points. You're listening to NPR News. Israel and the Palestinians have renewed their commitment to a ceasefire even as the violence continued. Two Palestinians were reportedly killed today and a dozen others injured in Gaza. Three Israeli soldiers were also hurt. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
For weeks, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had said no truce talks could proceed unless there was absolute calm. He relented to intense American pressure, but the atmosphere was clearly strained. Peres and Arafat canceled a joint press conference, leaving an aide to announce that security cooperation will resume. Israel has agreed to ease a military blockade on Palestinians, while Palestinians are expected to crack down on militants. But the two sides disagree on a time frame, and each faces strong internal opposition. A big test of the truce will come Friday, the one-year anniversary of the Intifada. Palestinians plan mass demonstrations, which in the past have ended in more bloodshed. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A black leader in Cincinnati says today's verdict in a controversial shooting case is an atrocity, but he says he's going to call on citizens to be peaceful. The shooting of an unarmed black man by a white police officer prompted rioting in April. Today, a judge acquitted the officer, Stephen Roach, in the killing. The judge decided the shooting was a split-second reaction to a very dangerous situation and a reasonable reaction on Roach's part, but dozens of protesters outside the courthouse disagreed. White House Budget Director Michael Daniels told a group of lawmakers today he expects the fiscal year's budget surplus to fall about $20 billion below earlier expectations. Daniels says the administration now predicts the surplus to reach about $120 to $130 billion. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nicholas de Torrente, was in Afghanistan in August, touring the medical facilities run by Doctors Without Borders, the international humanitarian medical group. He was head of their mission in Afghanistan and several other countries in 1997 and is now the USA executive director of Doctors Without Borders. The group's mission is to provide medical aid wherever it is needed, regardless of race, religion, politics, or sex. After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, Doctors Without Borders evacuated its 70 foreign nationals working in Afghanistan, leaving their clinics in the hands of their Afghan staff. How were the people of Doctors Without Borders told that they had to evacuate Afghanistan?
Well, there was a rising of tensions, and the final, we were very reluctant to leave. Obviously, we considered that our place is with the civilian populations, wherever they may be and whoever they may be, and we want to be present in war situations because that's where the victims are. So we were very reluctant to leave. We tried to make arrangements, but in the final event, what happened is that the Taliban authorities themselves told us that they could no longer guarantee the safety and security of our staff. And since we rely everywhere, we rely on the consent of the authorities to be able to operate. We rely on the fact that we're independent, that we are a humanitarian organization. We're not involved in any way in political issues, in religious issues, and so on. And this, is our guarantee, and usually enables us to operate. But in this case, when it came down to it, we were told that we would have to leave. And reluctantly, we left and we evacuated our 70 international staff who were present throughout the country to neighboring countries where they are trying to continue their work. We maintain a small group in the northeastern part of the country, controlled by the Northern Alliance, and there we still have medical teams.
When the Taliban told Doctors Without Borders that they couldn't guarantee your group's safety, was that code for saying, we're not going to try to protect you anymore. We don't really want you anymore. Get out.
Well, it's there are different interpretations, and we don't really know which one is the correct one at this point. Obviously, there have been radical elements within the Taliban who have felt very uneasy with the presence of foreigners inside the country. As I said, the presence of foreigners is important, we feel, to be able to bear witness to the situation and to be able to stand up on behalf of the population to some of their of the policies, for instance, access of women to healthcare, in our case. There were also, more moderate elements who saw that it was important to have humanitarian operations present, to be able to help the people. I mean, they also have families, they also have children, they also have they have wives and sisters that need health, for instance. So there was a mix, tensions within them as well as to whether we should be able to be allowed to operate. We don't know. I mean, did radical groups intend to, in the event of a military action, take humanitarian groups as hostages, use them as human shields, or did they fear that the population might turn against us? I mean, at this point, we don't know. We were just told that we had to go.
Were there certain Taliban regulations that you had to operate under in Afghanistan, regulating, for instance, the kind of treatment that women could receive, or what women doctors from Doctors Without Borders were or were not allowed to do. Were women doctors allowed to practice at all?
Yes, and there were regulations and there were constraints, and that's the sort of the space that we were trying to preserve at all costs. I mean, for us, we had a series of sort of bottom line conditions to be able to continue to work there and to make sure that we were making a positive difference. Those were, for instance, that women patients could come freely to our clinics, or the clinics we were supporting, that female staff, Afghan female staff, medical doctors, nurses, nursing assistants, and so on, would be allowed to work with us. And at times, we really had to fight to make sure that would be the case. There was a big attempt a few years ago to completely segregate, for instance, healthcare, and to have women-only hospitals with women staff in them. And the Taliban tried to impose this too. And we felt that would result in a reduction of access and make it more difficult for women to have access to healthcare. So we fought against that, and that we were able to maintain integrated structures where there you have men working and female staff working as well. This is a continuous struggle, and it was and one where we had doubts and questions, and we were questioning the effect of our actions constantly, as we do in other countries. But we felt, the bottom line was that we were helping people, that we were helping Afghan medical staff by being there. We were enabling them to stay in their country. A lot of them have already left. There's been a huge brain drain out of Afghanistan. And we were having a positive impact, even though it was very difficult.
When you say that you were questioning yourself, do you mean you were wondering whether your presence was bolstering the Taliban ideology?
I mean, I think it's a responsible thing to do, and we try to do this in every context to really assess, how beneficial our impact is, because of course, in one sense, you could argue that humanitarian agencies, not only ourselves but everyone, by being present, was, enabling the Taliban, for instance, not to deal with the needs of their people and to put resources into fighting the war, or it was, helping them gain legitimacy towards their own population. And given the type of regime it is, of course, we had these concerns. But as I said, we are a humanitarian aid is a very pragmatic endeavor, and it really seeks to help people and to help them get through a very difficult phase in their lives. And we felt that we were able to do that, including for the most vulnerable people in the country, including for women and children, and that we were, and that on balance was much more important.
Did the women doctors at Doctors Without Borders have to dress or behave in a certain way? Did they have to wear, body veils in order to work?
They as is the case in any Islamic country, they had to wear a scarf over their head, covering clothing. They had to, that was. But that's a concession that we make, and we make respectfully so to countries in which we work, everywhere in the Islamic world.
On your last trip to Afghanistan, you visited camps in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan. Were you seeing more and more refugees crossing the border into Pakistan?
Yes, we've seen over the past year an increased flow of refugees coming out of Afghanistan into Pakistan. And there they are joining many others, approximately 2 million others, who have been Afghan refugees who have been there for a number of years, some over 10 years. And the Afghan refugees who have been there for a long time are settled in camps that resemble villages with mud houses, and they've integrated into the Pakistani society and economy. Whereas the new incomers have been put into camps that are very makeshift, that are in very severe conditions, very harsh conditions, under tents, and purposefully kept in that situation, because there's been a growing tension between the Pakistani authorities and population of the border areas and the Afghan refugee population, and therefore Pakistan is quite comfortable with the prospect of having to have more refugees come into the country, and therefore even assistance to these new refugees was very difficult. We had to really pry the door open and to get access and to be able to do the basic medical services that we do in any refugee situation, such as vaccinating against measles, setting up a health clinic, providing emergency water. There was a camp called Jalazai Camp, which is the one that was a lot in the news, and this camp was very bleak indeed. And as we talk now of a new influx, I think it's important to bear in mind this underlying reluctance of Pakistan because of the growing difficulties of hosting Afghan refugees and the large numbers of them already there, in welcoming new refugees, and how difficult it's going to be able to provide assistance and to be able to protect these refugees who are often from different ethnic groups than the ones who are already there inside Pakistan. And this is a very difficult situation that we're trying to address now by scaling up our operations in Pakistan and in Iran.
Why don't you describe the conditions in the camp that you just mentioned?
Well, the camp is a moon-like landscape. Nothing grows in that area. It's an area where no crops are possible. And on this very harsh terrain, refugees have set up small little tents. They're regrouped very, closely regrouped together. There's a high population density in that camp, and they are controlled by the Pakistani authorities, who've been reluctant to give them refugee status. So they have difficulties in getting access to the job market, in doing things to fend for themselves. And so they've been very much dependent on aid that we've been able to provide from the outside, and that's been water, that's been medical services, nutritional services, but they're in a limbo, really, in a very precarious situation.
From what I've heard and read, it certainly sounds like the refugee camps in Pakistan during the war between Afghanistan and the Soviets were very radicalizing places. I mean, my understanding mm-hmm. is that a lot of the Taliban came out of the refugee camps in Pakistan, where they learned a very radical form of Islam. And I'm wondering if you think that the refugee camps still are radicalizing places.
Well, the refugee camps were, at the time, were in effect sanctuaries for Afghan civilians, but not only for Afghan civilians, but also for the Mujahideen fighting groups that were then being supplied there, supported there, and then were fighting inside the country. This was during the time of the resistance to the Soviet invasion, and that is what carried over into the 90s, even as the Soviets withdrew in the late 80s. Currently, the situation is a bit different for these new arrivals. These are really mainly civilians. These are really mainly people fleeing violence, persecution inside Afghanistan, and fleeing the effects of the drought. And as I said, they live in such difficult conditions that it's hard to see the kind of organization, the kind of structure, the kind of takeover by militant groups that we have seen among the older and more established camps in the past.
My guest is Nicholas de Torrente, USA Executive Director of Doctors Without Borders. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas de Torrente of Doctors Without Borders. Last month, he toured the group's medical facilities in Afghanistan. Have the doctors at Doctors Without Borders had a difficult time working with Afghan women under the Taliban? And by that, I mean, have Afghan women become so fearful and self-conscious under the Taliban that they're afraid to openly discuss their medical problems or afraid to have a doctor examine their bodies?
What we've seen, in fact, and it's quite interesting, is to see that how health structures have become places, some of the only places in Afghan society under the Taliban, where women were allowed to go. And so it became a kind of social, there was a social aspect to the health centers. Women were allowed to go there. They could remove their burqa, their veil. They could talk to each other. They could talk to outsiders. This is some of the only places where Afghan women could talk to people from abroad, international medical staff of women doctors, women nurses, and so it became a place for exchange and for social communication, where they could talk about their much broader grievances and their problems of everyday life, and they could exchange and support each other. So there was a social function to the health centers as well, not only a medical one, and that's why we felt it was so important to have these health structures continue, and to have women doctors from abroad and women nurses from abroad be in contact with Afghan women, because they're the only ones who could do that.
Were there Taliban guards at the Doctors Without Borders clinics to make sure that the Taliban code was being enforced at all times?
There were certainly attempts by certain groups of Taliban, in particular the religious police, to come in at, and it was not a constant thing, but they would come in at times and just check to make sure that nothing that they considered to be inappropriate was going on within the structures, to make sure that Afghan male medical staff would not be talking to Afghan female patients and so on. That the male staff and the female staff were not talking to each other and interacting, and so they would do that. It was harsher in certain areas such as Kabul. It was better in others such as Mazar-e-Sharif. It depended a little bit. It depended on the way the religious police, the local commander, how he was feeling about it. And it depended on the time period. It was not a constant thing, but yes, there was a policing in force by the Taliban on these aspects.
Humanitarian agencies in Afghanistan were reporting this week that the Taliban seized about 1,400 tons of food. What have you heard about that?
Well, we know that there's increasing pressure on the remaining humanitarian programs that are run by Afghan national staff inside Afghanistan, now that the international staff has withdrawn. And this is not surprising. The presence of international staff is really the guarantee, or at least the attempt to guarantee that that aid is going to the right people and is used in the right way. We're not surprised that this type of developments are happening. We have a hard time communicating with our staff inside Afghanistan, so we don't really know to what extent our own programs are affected. But we've had the request by the Taliban to hand over medical supplies, and the ARCH staff has not had much of a choice in that matter, under the current circumstances. So I think it's not surprising that there are increasing attempts by the Taliban to take over what is remaining of the humanitarian programs and infrastructure there. And that's why it's so important that we're able to resume operations with international foreigner volunteers and staff, so that they can see what's going on and they can stand up to the authorities.
Is there anything that you think you could tell us that might help explain some of what we've been witnessing? Because you've been in Afghanistan, because you've been in Pakistan, you've been a witness to a lot of events there, a witness to how a lot of people are feeling. Any thoughts you want to leave us with that might help us understand some of the motivation behind the attack?
I can't really speak to that. What I think the what I bring back from Afghanistan is the sense that people there, as in anywhere in the world, and as here in the United States as well, are looking for a decent life for their families. They're struggling to have to be safe. They're struggling to be able to feed their children and to provide for their education. I think there's this the basic humanity in that you see when you go to Afghanistan, and the immense pressures this population has been under from forces that are really outside of most of their of the control of most of them. I bring back the sense that we should not forget that, and we should continue to see the human aspect and the human face in people, even though they're very far away, even though the situation is very complex, even though it's somehow difficult to understand what is going on there, especially as we are reeling here under the shock of what has happened and struggling to find answers. But I would really urge us to continue to build bridges with what is the same there as is here, the human element.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck in your travels around the world.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nicholas de Torrente is Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. From Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of She Still Haunts Me, a novel by Katie Royfe about Lewis Carroll and Alice, his muse. And from Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the tricky business of naming military operations, like the newly named Operation Enduring Freedom. Also, our new poet laureate Billy Collins returns to read from his new book. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Billy Collins, is taking on his new position as U.S. Poet Laureate in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. We invited him back to Fresh Air to read some new and old poems. He has a new book called Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Selected Poems. Collins is a distinguished professor of English at Lehman College of the City University of New York and a visiting writer at Sarah Lawrence College. I asked him if the terrorist attacks are affecting how he sees his role as poet laureate.
Well, it's interesting. In the days following the attack, there was a kind of surge of poetry activity. And it seemed that there was a kind of need for poetry and people turning to me as the laureate for reactions to this. I found it, stepping back from it, I found it interesting that in a time of national crisis that we don't turn to the novel. You know, we don't say, well, we should all go out and see a movie. You know, that would be kind of a make us feel better. We turn to poetry. And it's interesting to put that next to the reputation of poetry as being the sort of poor little match girl of literature, you know, the neglected genre that that has a tiny audience. But it seems that in times like these, poetry stands up very well. I find that the following the events of September 11th, clearly there was and continues to be a torrent of language on the part of the coming from the media, and it's as if this language is trying to fill a hole somewhere that was left in America, and I don't think that language ever will fill that hole. But I think poetry stands apart, you know, in its own space, with its own integrity, and poetry, obviously, clearly one of its oldest functions, has been to is a place for grief to go, a place to ritualize grief and to make it possible to express in some coherent way feelings that seem to resist expression. Denise Levertov has a wonderful line about that. She says, grief is a hole you walk around in the daytime, and at night you fall into it.
Mm. I've been reading, you know, a lot of artists and journalists writing about how the impact of September 11th and this war on terrorism is affecting what artists want to say in their work and what filmgoers and music listeners and readers want. And I'm wondering if it's, I'm wondering if you've thought about this a lot, like how our inner lives and how what we want from art is changed at a time like this.
I think we want the same things that we always wanted. I don't think, as I've heard, irony is now passé. I feel irony is very much a part of our basic to our freedom of expression, you know. And I think also that occasions like this can create deadeningly false kinds of sincerity if we forget irony and humor, and also forget the everyday. I think that's the most important. In a catastrophe like this, I mean, the event certainly is too big and too stupendous for a single poem or painting or whatever to get its arms around. And because I think poetry particularly is private, it does announce personal feeling, and it does create a chapel, if you will, for the importance of everyday experience. And I think poetry should continue to do that. I think all poems stand against the wholesale murders that took place on September 11th. And I think that's more important than a poem that would be about that event, that would respond to that event in a mistakenly direct way. After all, you don't want to read a poem that, you know, delivers the news or makes the announcement that wholesale murder is morally bad.
Right. You didn't need the poem to tell you that.
You didn't need the poem to tell you that.
Maybe no. The terrorists did, but
that's true. Well, the terrorists have gone, I mean, they've done something that is, they've moved beyond language. You know, they've
Yes, I'll agree to that.
And I think there's a trouble with, I mean, we use metaphor to handle If anything, metaphor is in jeopardy, because we use metaphor to handle and explain experience. We try to compare something that's hard to understand to something that we know a little better. But I remember someone compared the collapse, that kind of sickening, heart-wrenching, architecturally spectacular collapse of the World Trade Center as looking like a cigarette burning down at high speed. But, of course, that you have to realize that there are thousands of people inside that cigarette. So at that point, the metaphor seems absurd, inadequate, even offensive.
No, it just seems like a bad metaphor, because
yeah, maybe.
A cigarette turns to smoke. It doesn't collapse in tons and tons and tons of rubble. I mean, even just as a stroke, that's just an awful metaphor in every way.
I'm reminded of a scene in that movie. I think it's called Going Home or Coming Home. It was a Vietnam War movie. And the character is on leave, and he joins up with his wife, I think in Japan, for some R&R. And when they finally have a moment alone, she turns to him. He's just come back from Vietnam, taking a break from Vietnam. And she says, "Well, what's it like?" And he looks at her in a kind of shocked way and says, "It's not like anything." And that's also another moment where comparison falls down and where there's no file for it. We have no file to put this. And that's why I think it's still in the air and will continue to be in the air. And will probably cast a shadow over the page of many writers.
My guest is our new poet laureate, Billy Collins. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Billy Collins is my guest, the United States new poet laureate. He also has a new book of poems. It's called Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Selected Poems. Billy, you were talking about the importance of still having poems that speak to everyday life. Is there a poem like that of yours you'd like to read?
Well, this is a poem called Morning. Why do we bother with the rest of the day? The swale of the afternoon, the sudden dip into evening, then night with his notorious perfumes, his many-pointed stars. This is the best, throwing off the light covers, feet on the cold floor, and buzzing around the house on espresso, maybe a splash of water on the face, a palm full of vitamins, but mostly buzzing around the house on espresso, dictionary and atlas open on the rug, the typewriter waiting for the key of the head, a cello on the radio, and, if necessary, the windows, trees, 50, 100 years old out there, heavy clouds on the way, and the lawn steaming like a horse in the early morning.
Billy, have you gone through a period of feeling both almost, you know, like relieved to be alive and guilty about feeling quite that way, that you should be feeling sad and not feeling that sense of relief?
No, I feel, I try to feel, this is something only a saint could sustain, but I try to maintain the feeling of gratitude. I think gratitude is the gratitude for existence, for daily experience, for being alive is at the core of so much poetry. And that poetry, so much of it, lyric poetry, reiterates the simple joy or the simple blunt fact of actually existing. That's my feeling about all haiku, just about. I mean, every haiku, I think, is essentially saying the same thing. It might be about a cherry tree or a frog jumping into a pond, but these incidental and seemingly peripheral observations are, at their very heart, are a declaration that I was here to see this. I existed. I saw this frog, period. And that sufficiency is, I think, part of the prayer of gratitude that a lot of poems offer.
You've also written some poems that are about death, but are also about life. I'm going to ask you to read one of them, and this is a poem called No Time. It was written pretty recently, I think too recently to be included in your new collection, Sailing Alone Around the Room. But I first read this poem a few months ago and quite like it. I'm going to ask you to read it for us.
No time. In a rush this weekday morning, I tap the horn as I speed past the cemetery where my parents are buried side by side under a smooth slab of granite. Then all day long I think of him rising up to give me that look of knowing disapproval while my mother calmly tells him to lie back down.
When did you write that? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the writing of the poem.
I think I wrote that in the car. That's one of these poems that just came out. I think I might have changed a word or two just for sound. But there is a road that goes by a cemetery where my parents are buried, and it's a road I travel sometimes and often feel compelled to stop and make a visit. But I did actually tap the horn. I just could feel that my father would feel that that was a rather inadequate acknowledgement of his passing, and that my mother, as usual, would step in to reassure him that the boy is okay. So I don't know. It's a little poem I'm fond of because I think it mixes two things I try to mix in a lot of poems, maybe not as successfully, which is something that's somewhat humorous and something that's somewhat sorrowful. The fact that my parents are buried there is a heavy bit of the poem, but the way I turn it into a kind of Thurber-esque marriage with the disapproving husband and the reassuring mother tries to leaven it with some lightness there, humor.
Reading that poem both before and after September 11th, I had slightly different reactions. After September 11th, I started thinking about how the people who died before it missed such a fundamental change in American life. I mean, I know several people who died this year, and to think that they left right before that they'll never know. They'll never know how everything changed.
I felt the same way, and I felt it pretty immediately. I felt, especially my parents, I felt that they were spared, that they did not have to see that. And that almost they, I think the people who died prior to September 11th, to me, insofar as I thought about them, felt like children that had been, that I was happy that they'd been protected and spared that that experience.
I'm going to ask you to choose a poem here.
Well, I have a poem called The Parade, which is about simply death as a natural process. The parade. How exhilarating it was to march along the great boulevards in the sun flash of trumpets and under all the waving flags, the flag of desire, the flag of ambition. So many of us streaming along, all of humanity really, moving in perfect sync, yet each lost in the room of a private dream. How stimulating the scenery of the world, the rows of the roadside trees, the huge blue sheet of the sky. How endless it seemed until we veered off the broad turnpike into a pasture of high grass, heading toward the dizzying cliffs of mortality. Generation after generation, we have shouldered forward under the gliding clouds until we high step off the sharp lip into space. So I should not have to remind you that little time is given here to rest on a wayside bench, to stop and bend to the wildflowers, or to study a bird on a branch, not when the young keep shoving us from behind, not when the old are tugging us forward, pulling on our arms with all their feeble strength.
Tell us about when you wrote that.
I think I came up, I mean, often a poem is just, well, for me, maybe it's my limits of my imagination, that I take one metaphor and just kind of extend it as far as I can. So it just occurred to me to use a parade as kind of the parade of life without exactly falling into that cliche. And I think there's a sense of that, you know, there is a natural progression, right? Your parents die before you do. They're supposed to. And your children die after you. And that logic, to get back to September 11th, which keeps intruding on any conversation anyone is having these days, that people went grotesquely out of order, the order, the natural progression of the parade toward the grave was grotesquely violated.
Billy Collins is my guest. He's the new U.S. Poet Laureate. He also has a new collection of poems called Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Selected Poems. You listen to a lot of jazz, and the recordings that you listen to, the musicians who you like most, show up in a lot of your poems. I'm going to ask you to read one of those poems. It's called Nightclub. Tell us something about it before you read it.
I actually, jazz is usually on in the house, and I write about jazz only because it tends to kind of leak into the writing as I'm going along. I usually don't sit down and say, I'm going to write about jazz. It was one afternoon, Johnny Hartman was playing in the background. I kept hearing, I was writing something else, but I kept hearing words like beautiful and foolish and love, and love and beauty and foolishness, and that they just seem to be kind of revolving words, almost as you would have in a sestina, although I didn't have the patience to write one of those. And then that's the way the poem got started. It's called Nightclub. You are so beautiful, and I am a fool to be in love with you, is a theme that keeps coming up in songs and poems. There seems to be no room for variation. I have never heard anyone sing, I am so beautiful, and you are a fool to be in love with me, even though this notion has surely crossed the minds of women and men alike. You are so beautiful, too bad you are a fool is another one you don't hear. Or, you are a fool to consider me beautiful. That one you will never hear, guaranteed. For no particular reason, this afternoon, I am listening to Johnny Hartman, whose dark voice can curl around the concepts of love, beauty, and foolishness like no one else's can. It feels like smoke curling up from a cigarette someone left burning on a baby grand piano around 3 o'clock in the morning, smoke that billows up into the bright lights, while out there in the darkness, some of the beautiful fools have gathered around little tables to listen, some with their eyes closed, others leaning forward into the music as if it were holding them up, or just twirling the loose ice in a glass, slipping by degrees into a rhythmic dream. Yes, there is all this foolish beauty born beyond midnight that has no desire to go home, especially now when everyone in the room is watching the large man with the tenor sax that hangs from his neck like a golden fish. He moves forward to the edge of the stage and hands the instrument down to me and nods that I should play. So I put the mouthpiece to my lips and blow into it with all my living breath. We are all so foolish, my long bebop solo begins by saying, so damn foolish, we have become beautiful without even knowing it.
You were telling me you usually end your readings with that poem. Why do you choose that poem to end with?
I think it says something almost sentimental at the end, but I think I really mean what I said there at the end, and perhaps the whole poem is a sort of elaborate setup that allows me to say that we are beautiful. It could be that corny.
Billy Collins, thank you so much for talking with us and for reading for us.
It's been all my pleasure, Terry.
Billy Collins is the new Poet Laureate of the United States. His new book is called Sailing Alone Around the Room, New and Selected Poems. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the tricky business of naming military operations. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld acknowledged last week that the Pentagon had blundered in giving the military campaign against terrorism the name Operation Infinite Justice, a phrase that a number of Muslims found blasphemous since it seemed to promise what only Allah could deliver. Yesterday, the Pentagon announced that the new name would be called Operation Enduring Freedom. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg reports, the naming of operations has been a tricky business for the military since they started the practice in World War II.
The most famous World War II operation was called Overlord, the name personally selected by Winston Churchill for the Normandy invasion. That name may have had a sense of majesty and patriarchal vengeance, as the historian David Kahn put it, but it wasn't very informative about the mission. Nor were other Allied operation names like Avalanche, Husky, and Mulberry. In fact, Churchill himself ordered that the names of operations shouldn't suggest their character, particularly after British intelligence intercepted references to a German operation called Sea Lion and guessed that it was a plan to invade Britain. The Allies kept their operation names strictly secret, to the point where even an inadvertent mention could trigger an alarm. A few weeks before D-Day, the names Utah, Omaha, and Overlord showed up as answers in the London Daily Telegraph's crossword puzzle. Officers from MI5 rushed to interview the Surrey schoolteacher who had composed the puzzles, but the whole business turned out to be a bizarre coincidence. It wasn't until after the war that names like Overlord and Avalanche became household words. At that point, the War Department realized that there could be a public relations advantage in creating a new category of unclassified operation nicknames. Even so, most of the post-war names were no more descriptive than the secret code names of World War II. President Eisenhower sent the Marines to Lebanon in 1957 under the name Operation Blue Bat, and the military operations in Vietnam tended to have names like N-Sweep, Pocket Money, and Abilene. True, generals occasionally picked operation names that had more martial connotations, but that could backfire. When General Ridgway named one Korea Operation Killer, the State Department complained that he had soured the ongoing negotiations with the Chinese. In Vietnam, 15 years later, General Westmoreland was forced to rename Operation Masher when President Johnson objected that the name didn't reflect the administration's pacification emphasis. And the press came down on the Reagan administration when it dubbed the invasion of Grenada Operation Urgent Fury, which seemed excessively bellicose for a mission to rescue some medical students on a Caribbean island. That unhappy experience with the name Urgent Fury was one of the things that led the Bush administration in the late 80s to start choosing operation names that were calculated to shape political perceptions. The first of these was Operation Just Cause, the 1989 invasion of Panama. That name irked some critics who had reservations about the legitimacy of the invasion. The New York Times ran an editorial on the name entitled Operation High Hokum. But a number of news anchors picked up on the phrase Just Cause, which encouraged the Bush and Clinton administrations to keep using those tendentious names. Just Cause was followed by the operations called Desert Shield and Desert Storm, as the word operation swelled to apply to a full-blown war. And after that came Restore Hope in Somalia, Uphold Democracy in Haiti, and operations in the Balkans that went by names like Shining Hope, Determined Force, and Provide Promise. All of this has turned the naming of operations into a delicate art. In an article not long ago in the Quarterly of the U.S. Army War College, Lieutenant Colonel Gregory Siminski offered several naming guidelines. First, he says, make the name meaningful. Don't waste a public relations opportunity. Remember that the operation name is the first bullet in the war of images. Second, identify and target the critical audience. Decide whether your name is intended to fire up the troops, win domestic support, allay the concerns of other nations, or intimidate the enemy. And finally, he says, make it concise and memorable. Find a name that vividly evokes the characteristics of the operation that you want people to focus on. Actually, those guidelines are good advice whether you're naming a military operation or a new SUV. It's all a matter of branding. And it's no accident that the new style names like Just Cause were introduced at around the same time the cable news shows started to label their coverage of major stories with catchy names and logos. That practice actually began in 1979 when ABC packaged its special coverage of the Iran hostage crisis as a late-night program called America Held Hostage, which later developed into Nightline. but it was left to CNN and then the other cable news networks to start routinely bannering every major story, high or low. War in the Gulf, Death of a Princess, Flashpoint Kosovo, Boy in the Middle, remember that one? Investigating the President, A Nation Waits, The Search for Chandra Levy. Like the Pentagon's operation names, the network's banners suggest a master narrative for a stream of disconnected news and comment. It's a convenient device for packaging stories like Elian Gonzalez or even the Florida election results, which do have the feel of real-life miniseries. But the events that began to unroll on September 11th are too far-reaching and open-ended to be summed up in a single phrase. You could see the network struggling to find a unifying theme for their coverage as they went from one banner to another. Assault on America, America Unites, America Rising, America on Alert, America Fights Back. But no banner was elastic enough to stretch over all the stories that were coming in from New York and Washington, Vero Beach and Los Angeles, Cairo and Islamabad. And the banners are likely to sound even more simplistic as the story runs its unpredictable course. I keep thinking of some lines from a poem by Robinson Jeffers. History falls like rocks in the dark. All will be worse confounded soon. But at least the networks can keep reframing their narrative from one day to the next. The military have had an even bigger problem, coming up with a name for an operation which is going to be waged over many years in many different theaters and whose outcome is still pretty murky. The efforts to date have been pretty hapless. Operation Infinite Justice was a public relations disaster in the Muslim world, and the new name Operation Enduring Freedom has problems of its own. For one thing, I'm not sure if the Pentagon people stopped to think that the phrase is ambiguous, and that some people may choose to interpret it to mean that freedom is something you have to bear, rather than something that abides. But even if they'd named it Lasting Freedom, I suspect that it would have made Churchill uneasy. He was partial to naming operations after Roman gods, war heroes, or famous racehorses, words with a nonspecific meaning and a vaguely heroic sound. And he warned against picking what he called words which imply an overconfident sentiment. He knew better than most how history delights in creating unforeseen ironies.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tell yourself it won't be for long. You're between dark and dawn.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Nick Lowe returns to perform some old favorites and songs from his new CD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Standing still, it's all flat and forlorn in between.